Friends, Mercedes here, and I'm going to talk to you guys about an awesome, rad, much-needed company called Sheltered Co. Sheltered Co. was created by a mother for her autistic daughter. It's crocheted by hand in Los Angeles with deadstock fabric with no added fillers. This is a weighted blanket that helps children and adults regulate their body from stresses of everyday life. It also helps with better sleep, and you guys, it's gorgeous to look at and will make any room in your home look cozier and more comfortable. Please, if you're in the market for a weighted blanket, and even if you're not, but you need better sleep and to regulate your body or your child's body, please head over to shelteredco.com. Use the discount code LUCKYFEW15 for 15% off and purchase yourself a beautiful quality blanket.
All right. Hey, friends. Welcome to another episode of the Lucky Few podcast, where we are shifting the narrative by shouting the worth of people with Down syndrome. This is Micah,
Mercedes,
and Heather.
And today we are joined by Sarah and Sabrina from the popular Instagram account Able Appetites to discuss all things feeding with your little ones with Down syndrome. We are so excited to learn from them. So thanks for joining us, friends. Welcome to the Lucky Few podcast.
Okay, parents, educators, pastors, friends, everybody listening, we are headed back to school. It is time, back to school. I'm so excited that as we head back to school, my new children's book, Different, A Great Thing to Be, will also be making its way into classrooms. I believe this book is a great resource as we help our kids navigate the school year as they have opportunities to notice, embrace, and celebrate the different in themselves and in their classmates and those around them. And I trust this book will serve as a powerful tool to help you do just that. And to be sure, here at The Lucky Few, we've created a different classroom kit full of additional resources for you to download and use to create a whole different kind of lesson for our kids and our students. Here's what we have included in our different classroom kit. We have a different conversation guide, which helps get the conversation going with you and your students, a different self-portrait, a different kind of bingo, a tell me more about that writing activity, a writing activity that what I like about you, and printable kindness cards that you can print, cut out, and send home with your students and have your students send to one another. All of these items are available to you for free. This is a free resource we've created to go along with the book, Different, A Great Thing to Be. You can head to heatheravis.com/different to download this free resource guide and print these out to use in your home, your classroom, your churches, wherever you want to use them, because friends, different is a great thing to be.
Okay. I'm so happy we're talking about this, ladies, because I just ran into a mom who has a baby with Down syndrome, and I think he's about 12 months now, and he's doing really great with feeding. And that was sunflower. Like, she was not too picky and she liked to eat. She liked the textures. So when the therapist would approach me and they're like, how do you think she's doing with feeding? I would be like, oh my gosh, she's so good, because she was just eating. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't later until like two or three where I actually found out she did have a feeding issue, when it was more in conjunction with her tongue movement and how she was eating. So if you are a parent out there and you're like, my child with Down syndrome is such an eater, so epic, and someone asks you that question and you kind of shoo it off because you think, you know, my kid is eating, they are actually eating, so it must be fine. I would ask that then therapist to check them, say like, hey, can you watch my child eat and see how they are manipulating the food in their mouth and how they're using their tongue, and are they using both sides, you know, all those things. Cause I didn't know to look for that. until I had a different therapist who brought it up, right? You know, each person, I feel like different therapists do different things, maybe go deeper into one thing or not. So could be just something in those early years to look into, or ask your therapist who asks you the question, say, well, what do you think? I think they're doing fine, but what do you think? Mm-hmm. That's my tidbit.
That's good. Super helpful. I feel like there's so many things are getting thrown at you when you have a little one with Down syndrome. And yeah, you're sort of like, oh, if it's fine, then let's not add another therapist onto the roster.
Exactly.
And so it is really good to just get an expert to take a look.
Definitely. And you can't know what you don't know.
Yep.
And that's why it's important to tell our stories and to listen to people's stories and learn from other people's experiences. I have a funny story with Macy when she was young. So when I was a first time mom, you guys, I was like such a go-getter, and I was going to be this best mom ever. And I, with feeding, I was like, I will not have a picky eater. And the idea, I don't know how prevalent this is now, but Mason's 13. So almost 13 years ago, let's say 12 years ago, it's that idea that you introduce kids to the same food like 20 times before they reject it.
Yeah.
And now three kids in, I'm like, bless the mom who did that or does that, because who has time to do that? And there's a lot to it. I'm joking a little bit, but I felt like that with Mason. And I was like, she's going to eat everything. And I really wanted like high immunity boosting foods for her, like foods high in vitamin C. So my most wild food that I fed Mason was dandelion greens. And I bought it at a farmer's market and steamed them, sauteed them up with like garlic and salt and pepper, probably not salt. I don't think I put salt in anything actually for her, and then blended it up and fed it to her. And I mean, if you've had dandelion greens, they're like medicinal. They're very potent. And I think I like blended it up with, I don't know, some kind of a milk or probably her formula or something. And she ate it, and she had the most disturbing poops for like a week, where it was like the first time I'm like, oh my gosh, I took her to the doctor. What did she eat? What did she eat? I'm like, oh, dandelion greens. Her little stomach was like, what the heck, Heather? And then my other one that was so terrible wasn't terrible. I gave her papaya all the time. Yeah. And that was just such an easy one. And she loved papaya, and papaya is super high in vitamin C. And she had this reaction to it where if I didn't change her diaper right away, she would get the worst rashes on her little bottom. And so those are my two things. God bless Mason. But you know, 13 years old, she eats anything for the most part. So
maybe. That's amazing. So you did it.
Something. And then enter little August Riker. And he, for the first 6 months of eating foods, he ate hummus. He was like a sensitive, he was a sensory guy, like a sensory seeker in flavor, but sensory resistant to texture. Mm. So he would eat hummus, but I would like have to squeeze the juice of half a lemon in it. And he would just eat that, or avocado with tons of lemon and garlic salt. And those were that was all he ate for the first 6 months of eating things. And I thought, that's okay. Like avocado and hummus, I think we're okay. Those are good things.
Pretty healthy.
For you. Yeah. And it was while he was still mostly getting a formula. So since my kids were adopted, I didn't breastfeed. You can breastfeed with adopted kids, but it wasn't something that was going to work for us. So I think that I also tried to overcompensate feeling like I wish that they would have had breast milk predominantly. Anyways, those are my early memories of feeding with my little munchkins.
Mm. Wow. I think the sensory thing is so interesting, because Ace's sensory stuff was always like, he was texture that he was seeking. He just wants crunchy, but he also is all about the sour, and that for a while he was really into hot stuff, and I was putting like hot sauce in his
I love that. It's awesome.
Unreal. I love that.
But yeah, I love our little sensory seekers. It makes things so much more interesting. Mm-hmm. Which I feel like is a good transition into what we're going to be talking about today with Sarah and Sabrina from Able Appetites, because they're just so bold in the ways that they present food to kids, the ways that they talk about the introduction of food and making everything available. I love their Instagram account. I feel inspired by it, and mm-hmm. I'm excited for our chat with them. But before we go to the interview, Heather, you have a sweet and lovely review to read, don't you?
I do have a review to read from a listener. Ski 121212 says, "This podcast is one of my very favorites to listen to. I appreciate learning new things about myself as I listen to these mamas share about themselves. I also like learning from their wide variety of guests. The more we learn, the more we grow." Amen. Ski 121212. That's kind of what we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. So if you are a listener, don't forget. I mean, if you're a listener, you're listening. So obviously, if you hear me saying this, you're a listener. So that means that you can review the show. You can do that on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we may just read that review aloud next week. We're so unbelievably thankful for every review that you guys leave. It means the world to us. So thank you for that. And I too am very excited for this conversation, friends. It is a very helpful and good conversation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
All right. Well, you guys, let's jump over. Let's hear from Sarah and Sabrina and learn more about what they're doing over there at Able Appetites.
I am so excited to introduce Sarah and Sabrina. They are mothers raising children with Down syndrome who have made it their mission to use social media to educate fellow looking mamas on feeding strategies. They run the account Able Appetites that focuses on resources and community for parents feeding kiddos with Down syndrome. Support and transition from breast, bottle, or tube feeding solid foods. So welcome to the show, Sarah and Sabrina.
Thank you so much for having us.
I am thrilled to have you guys. As I said earlier, feeding therapy has been such a major part of my life and Ace's life. And there are so many things that, like, strategies that we started when Ace was like one that are still part of his life. He loves dried mango because that was the thing we used when he was one to, like, strengthen his jaw. And it is still his very favorite thing in the world. So I'm so excited to talk to you all. I would love for you to, I would love for you guys to introduce yourselves. Tell us about your families, your connection to Down syndrome, and your own experiences with feeding.
Okay, well, I'll just go ahead and jump in. I am Sarah, and I live in Austin, Texas with my husband and our three kiddos. We have a son who's 7 and a daughter who's 5, and then our youngest, Cleo, who has Down syndrome. I've been staying at home with my kids, but prior to that, I worked as a licensed clinical social worker in an elementary school. So I was often like part of an interdisciplinary team with speech therapists, but honestly, I did not understand all of the hats that they wear until I had my own child who needed services, and needed speech therapy. Kind of like going back to my pregnancy, we received a probable prenatal diagnosis, and it was just delivered to us in such a traumatizing and terrible way. And so I kind of felt like my whole pregnancy, I was like reeling from that experience. And then because I didn't feel like we were really given any information about Down syndrome or connected to other families, I felt like pretty much spent the pregnancy trying to like sort through all of this misinformation about Down syndrome. I remember, you know, just Googling and reading just all of these scary, scary things that might happen. And so that was kind of the focus of the pregnancy, was just trying to figure out like what is true, what is not true. And feeling like I was very siloed in doing that, you know, doing that on my own. And when Cleo was actually born and she did have Down syndrome, she ended up spending time in the NICU. She had pulmonary hypertension and feeding difficulties. And so we started working with a lactation consultant because I really wanted to breastfeed her, and a speech therapist to help her bottle feed. The goal was to get home. And so even though I wanted to breastfeed her, I wanted to do whatever we needed to do to get her out of the NICU and home with us. I had also just received a lot of messages that, you know, babies with Down syndrome cannot breastfeed. They do not breastfeed. It would be like, you know, she would be a unicorn if she breastfed. And so I started to feel like in the NICU, even though we were getting some support, like maybe I'm fighting for something that just isn't possible. It felt like kind of like my first experience advocating for my child, but feeling so alone in doing that. And I just had no idea, you know, that there were online support groups out there for women who wanted to breastfeed or pump for their baby. I had no idea that there was an organization called Julia's Way that was, you know, writing a book about this topic and, you know, had personal stories of many, many babies with Down syndrome who had been able to breastfeed. So again, it was just a lonely time. It was a time where I felt a lot of uncertainty. And Cleo did ultimately start to latch and breastfeed around 4 months old. And so it was like, right when we feel like we're getting into the groove with that, it's like, okay, now we need to start talking about or thinking about how to introduce her to solids. And so I remember walking in and having a conversation with my pediatrician, who we love, who is amazing, but he is not a feeding therapist. And he just said, you know, children with Down syndrome, they have to be spoon-fed purees. That's really important for their oral motor development. And it had nothing to do with Cleo and Cleo's abilities. It was like babies with Down syndrome do this, and this is just what the norm is.
Right.
So I hadn't gone down that road with our breastfeeding experience. I felt at that point like a little bit more empowered to say, okay, I can like hear this information, I can receive this message, and then instead of that being the end of the road, like I can take what he said to me to our therapeutic team. I can start connecting with other moms in our online support group. I had a million questions and I wanted to talk to other moms. I wanted to talk to other people who had been down that road before me. And that is when I connected with Sabrina.
That's so cool. So Sabrina, you want to take it from here?
And my story is in some ways similar to Sarah's. So I'm a speech language pathologist. I've been an SLP now for over a decade. My primary areas of expertise are in autism early intervention and feeding. I also found out prenatally that I was going to have a child with Down syndrome. And in a weird way, I had kind of always thought that I was going to have a child with special needs. I don't know if other people's parents have that experience too. And I had worked on a few research studies that had children with Down syndrome in them. And so from the very outset, it was really important to me that the way we shared with other people that he was going to be in our lives and that he was going to have this difference or disability, whatever, however you'd like to phrase it, was a positive thing and that we were overjoyed to have him in our lives. And so we also kind of started in that same sort of area and honestly started experiencing ableism to some degree, even like while he was still growing gestationally, and how our doctor treated him and the things that we were told, kind of the same way that Sarah mentioned, well, yes and no. But then I also felt really passionately that I wanted to breastfeed because I have an autoimmune disease and have food allergies. And so I really wanted to be able to have an impact on his palate shape, on what foods he was being offered. So that then if he did have allergies the same way that I do, that would help support him, you know, in feeling his best from a gut health perspective. Because that was something that over the last, you know, several years of discovering my autoimmune disease and how that was impacting me had really changed how I viewed health and how I viewed food and what made me feel better, essentially, and more able to matriculate in my life to my best ability. And then, so like Sarah said, we met when I think Cleo was had just turned 6 months or was like around 6 months, and Graham is a couple months younger than she is, through our DSDN birth year. And she put out a message with Cleo eating watermelon and asked who else is going to be doing baby-led weaning. And I was like, pick me. And we quickly awesome. Became friends and started exchanging who knows how many text messages. I think that probably far more than we'd like to count. But it was such a relief to have somebody else to talk to. So she was already kind of starting out on this. And about a month before she had just started with baby-led weaning, I had been sort of advocating for Graham around some of his feeding abilities. So we also had a short NICU stay of a couple weeks due to transient pulmonary hypertension, and he had an open PDA and open PFO along with jaundice, which all led to, you know, fatigue. And I advocated while he was in the NICU for him to have an NG tube placed, which probably isn't that common for a parent to ask for one, but as a speech language pathologist, I really felt like he was able to breastfeed. He latched within the first 24 hours, and I was so excited that I didn't want to supplant him learning to breastfeed with bottle feedings. We ended up going home on a alternating schedule eventually in order to get home, the things that we do to get home, right, from the NICU. So alternating bottle and breastfeeds. And that experience of being in the NICU for 2 weeks, while the people that we interacted with, and honestly, my situation was to some degree ideal because I was able to room in, I had my own room with him. It really changed my perspective on, I know it is unheard of. It really changed my perspective on medical care because my agency as his mom felt like it was completely taken away. And it was just, you need to do this or this is this, or if you want to go home, you're just going to have to suck it up and, you know, do X, Y, Z. Even if sometimes I felt like those choices weren't necessarily equating to a better outcome. So for instance, I actually caught Graham's cyanosis in before we even landed in the NICU. We were still in well baby for a day. And it was during a bottle feed that they had wanted me to use. And I had brought along a Dr. Brown's paste infant feeder for him with a newborn nipple and a preemie nipple. I was all ready, you know, in case he needed bottle feeds. But they insisted that I try the bottle that they had, which, and so I tried to accommodate and feed him sideline and do all the things that I knew as a speech language pathologist to do to help him pace. And his whole shoulder turned blue, even with that. But he wasn't doing the same thing with breastfeeding because he was able to kind of control more of what was happening, you know, as his lungs were kind of in this failure, you know, to some degree. So I felt like bottle feeding wasn't that helpful for him. I saw him get overfed to the point that he would vomit and someone would call it reflux. And I would say, but it's not really a true reflux, you know, because he's not spitting up after every single feed. So this entire viewpoint of advocacy and how everyone has an opinion about food. So since all of us to some degree eat or enjoy food or nutrition, you know, even if that's by a tube or what have you, everyone has an opinion on it. Every nurse that came in our room, every single doctor had a different opinion. And then I felt like I continued to see the same thing shared in our birth year group. And sometimes it was hard for me as a speech language pathologist to see some of the things that were shared or recommended or that people were told that they couldn't do. And I think that Sarah and I felt that same sort of passion to help other families and maybe cut through some of these different varying opinions from professionals and, you know, your lovely aunt who fed you as a baby or, you know, what whoever that might be, you know, giving you feeding advice that sometimes made it more confusing for parents who were already having to make too many decisions.
Absolutely. And so you guys came together and you, when did Able Appetites begin? what's the story of its creation?
So we've been running for about a year now, a little over a year now. And that's sort of the story of its creation. Was we just bonded over the fact that our babes were able to succeed and seem to learn so many different skills from being exposed to whole foods using a modified baby-led weaning approach. And I'll say that we certainly are not pressuring anybody else to choose that method, but we also, because we do want to be inclusive and we want to support all different kinds of eaters. And if parents aren't comfortable with that method, or if they're having to tube feed at this point in time, we want to support them where they're at in the moment. But we do still feel passionately and felt like it worked really well for our kiddos. So, and we wanted to share that.
Awesome. I feel like I just want to, first of all, say I'm amazed, like trophies to Sarah for trying to breastfeed for 4 months before Cleo took it on. I think that's amazing, Sarah. And I think like the persistence that is required for breastfeeding our kiddos with Down syndrome is, it's just really intense. It's really hard. And I'm so grateful you guys are doing this because there's just not that much support for moms who are trying to breastfeed. And I felt pretty alone and like I was just trying to figure it out. And I was, you know, I had two older kids and I had breastfed them. And it was just an entirely new experience breastfeeding Ace. And the amount of time, especially in those newborn days where he would like, was, could never wake up. And we were sticking frozen peas on his feet and taking him outside and stressing him and, you know, like all those things. But I'm just so grateful for moms like you who are seeing the need and stepping up and making something happen to support other parents out there trying to make it work.
I had the opportunity to just read a little bit about the background of your podcast and how you all saw, okay, well, there's this sort of gap and like, let's just do it. I mean, I feel like as moms, it just lit a fire in me of like, I don't want other parents and caregivers to feel like I did, that I'm just like grasping for straws. I want to like, not only just create a space where we can provide resources, but like show babies eating, talk about all the nuances that go into feeding our kids. So I think the more stories, storytelling is just so powerful in our community, the more stories that, that we can share, the more empowering that is for families.
Totally, totally. I mean, and just in the stories you guys shared of like the doctor who says, oh, kids with Down syndrome can't breastfeed, or Sabrina, the nurses who are like, well, you just need to try this using the bottle. And, or the doctor who's like, this is how you feed your child at 4 months or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. We need other stories.
Absolutely.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that that's one of the things that made us choose to, instead of only using our voices, to also present the stories of families and the stories of professionals, because I feel like it's a benefit to us that we aren't saying necessarily that we know every single thing about feeding. What we're saying is we're going to help you collect and find other resources through us. Like, yes, we are a resource, but we're not necessarily the end stop, because I think that something that as an SLP that I realized that maybe young mothers of children with Down syndrome don't realize is that not all therapists are the same. Like your early intervention agency, and you already know this, Micah, because you've probably already, you know, been really, you've had the opportunity to be selective about who it is that you would like to work with. But oftentimes early intervention assigns you someone, if they even do that. Sometimes they tell you, oh, I'm sorry, you need to wait until they're 12 months or 18 months before you can get feeding therapy. And they put all of these caveats and rules in place, which really are just a way for them to protect their own time and their own finances, because early intervention, you know, is paid for by the state. And it's not because people are bad. It's just because they get into this routine of this is the way we do it. And it's easy to build those types of habits. But when you're a new parent and you're also thinking about a heart surgery and you're thinking about having to learn how to clean a G-tube or, you know, whatever it might be, and you're doing five other therapy appointments a week or doctor's appointments, you don't realize that if someone is not using a strategy that makes you feel comfortable or that fits your family lifestyle, that you can ask for something different. So I just want all parents to realize that they have so much more agency and choice in what they can do, even in terms of if you're doing feeding therapy, what the foods that are being offered. I think I always feel really hesitant to share what foods we're eating because I don't want people to feel like they need to eat the foods that we're eating. That's not the goal. The goal is for your child to enjoy your family life and eat the foods that your family consumes. And of course, to, you know, get the nutrition intake and things like that, that you would like for them to have, but most of all, for them to listen to themselves, to know when they're hungry, to stop when they're full, and to be able to really participate in a family meal. And I think that we often undersell the usefulness of that. It sounds so simple, but it's not.
Yep. And sometimes the simplest things are the things that are most impactful in our kids' lives.
Absolutely.
I would love to know, you guys, just if you can give us a brief overview of like some of the common challenges that kids with Down syndrome tend to have with feeding and kind of why those things might exist, and maybe even like some simple strategies for working through those challenges.
Yeah. So I think that one of the most common difficulties is a difficulty progressing to harder to chew foods. A lot of children with Down syndrome seem to plateau with pureed foods and multiple solids, and have difficulty learning how to chew, whether it's because of low tone, whether it's because of lack of exposure to foods to chew, because we, after having faced this trauma in the NICU or when they're young, we want to protect them from things that we feel like might be dangerous, especially if other medical professionals are telling us that it's dangerous to offer them things that are difficult to chew. And so I think that that is one area that we see quite frequently. Then there is another subset of children who have more extreme oral aversion as a result of medical trauma or medical experiences. And then there's the whole sensory system and how the sensory system impacts their ability, because a lot of children with Down syndrome do experience sensory differences. But I think all of us as people have different, slightly different sensory systems. So for instance, I don't really love a lot of loud noise. And some children with Down syndrome don't really love being very messy, and that's okay. Or they might love to be messy. You know, it really can kind of swing the full pendulum of the sensory system, but knowing that and having tools for how to talk about that and how that might impact their relationship with food is important.
I think for me, you know, I had, we had chosen baby-led weaning for my other two children. And basically, I don't even know if we've talked about what that actually is. But it's basically just a philosophy that sort of skips over the spoon feeding of purees. And so the child is included in the family meal, and we're offering the family meal to the baby from the very beginning when they're starting solids. Mm-hmm. So of course, that's going to be modified in like the way that we're cutting foods to reduce the risk of choking and also being mindful of the sodium. But the baby or the child is sort of given the control to bring that food to their mouth. And with babies with Down syndrome, that may require some modification. So for example, when we, at 7 months, when we tried to put avocado on Cleo's high chair tray, it's really hard for her to hold that and to bring that to her mm-hmm. mouth. And so we learned that there were some modifications that can be really helpful with babies with low tone. So we used a preloaded spoon where it's sort of like, it was like a silicone spoon that can, with the avocado, mash that up and then offer her the spoon so that she's in control of bringing that spoon to her mouth. We learned about, you know, coating the avocado chia seeds or almond meal. So that gave her a better grip so that she could pick that up and bring that to her mouth. So I guess in terms of the challenges, it was really important to us to make sure that she was eating safely from the beginning. Sabrina mentioned the piece about trauma. And I know that even though I had fed to other children before, I came in with a lot of trauma, having been through the breastfeeding experience and being just really scared. So working with your feeding at your child's feeding team, taking a CPR class, watching videos to sort of understand what is the difference between gagging and choking. That was really important for us. Making sure she was in a high chair that was allowing her to be like properly aligned. When we started offering solid food, she was in a chair that would have probably worked for my two older children, but she was literally like slumping over to the side, like leaning over. And man, if you are not able to like sit upright, it's going to be very difficult to bring food to your mouth. So there were all these little things that we learned, little modifications that were really helpful for her in learning how to self-feed. I think the biggest one for me was like how much it had affected me to hear other professionals sort of make these assumptions about her. It was really like, I had to shift to be like, okay, how do I view her? Like, if I am seeing her as being incapable of doing things, then I'm not necessarily providing the opportunities to show me differently. So there was definitely, there's just so much, And I think that like, when we start talking about feeding, it is emotional. It brings up so much for people. I still have a million and one questions. So I think that there was just a lot that I kind of personally needed to work through to get to a place where I was regulated enough to have mealtime be calm. I'm not bringing in my own stress. Our little ones, they're soaking up so much. They're looking at us. They're like responding to, our emotional states. And if I'm coming in hovering and stressed out and due to my own trauma, that can really affect our babe's experience of mealtime.
And I think that building positive oral experiences and positive mealtime experiences is a big tip for us. In addition to the postural stability, which isn't just for babies, that's for kids too. Not just with eating, but even, doing their homework, because if you're not in a good, safe, supported seat, then you're more likely to fidget and have poorer attention. There's all kinds of, things that we can say about that, but it definitely helps protect you better. I think that allowing them to get messy from a really early age and a self-feeding aspect, we know that our kids need a little bit of extra practice with motor planning things, especially. And starting from day one, regardless of what texture you offer, allowing them to self-feed, whether it's with a silicone spoon, like Sarah mentioned, or a regular spoon or food, it doesn't really matter. But it allows them this repetition that they get so that by the time they become more opinionated, they are capable of making those decisions themselves. We often try to mention the division of responsibility as well as something that we support. And that's where you as the parent decide what you're going to serve, where you're going to serve it. And then the child gets to decide whether or not they eat it and how much of it they eat, which is a really hard paradigm, especially when you've had to start off possibly in the NICU with a lot of emphasis on weight gain. So many of our kids have to think so much about how much they eat, but we see in the research and the literature from dietitians that oftentimes that backfires, that if we put a lot of pressure on children to eat a certain quantity, eventually they just tell us, no, like I'm not going to do this. So trying to start people off with those concepts so that they can really let their kid drive this experience. And of course, it's different if you have a feeding disorder or a feeding difference that requires intervention. You might need to be talking about other strategies, and we share those as well. There are so many different feeding strategies out there that as a parent, it can be really confusing. And sometimes therapists don't even tell you what feeding strategy they're using, which also makes it hard for you as the parent to make an educated choice about whether or not that's the strategy that needs to be used. And I feel like Sarah and I are constantly living in this push and pull between the ableism that's present in saying that a child can't do something,
right,
and the ableism that's present in saying, I need to provide you with so much therapy that you don't look like you have Down syndrome.
Yes.
Which is not necessary, right? Like, that's too far. And so living in this gray space between how do we utilize these things, but still honor the children that our children are supposed to be. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot. And it's, I think there's just, this is a conversation we have all the time that Heather and Mercedes and I have all the time of where, what is the intention behind the therapy and how do we live in that space of like what we offer our kids, but also choosing to embrace every part of who they are and celebrating every part of who they are. So I have one more question for our listeners out there. If they, you know, I think feeding therapy is available in some places more so than it is in others. What would you encourage our listeners if they are sitting here going, oh my gosh, I didn't even know I could get this kind of help for my kid. Where do I even start? What would you tell them?
That's an excellent question because like you said, it is so different. And we have people from all over the world, and I'm sure you do too, and your listeners who don't have the same access to feeding therapy. Right. I would say that unfortunately or fortunately, thanks to COVID, there are a lot of professionals now who offer consultations. So even if you can't access a feeding therapist in your area, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't get support. Now, obviously that costs money to do quite frequently, but you also have control over how often you can afford to do that. And you can certainly try to build your own program if you feel confident with that. We have families sending us messages sometimes daily asking for support in those areas. And of course, we do our best to point them in the right direction. We tell them what books we know of and what websites we know of, whether it's just an Instagram post from another professional or another mom, and ways that they can connect with other people who are maybe experiencing something similar. But that's something that I think that we are still learning, and we are perpetually adding to, we have this resource list that we're constantly adding resources to, I don't know how big it will be one day, but it is already quite large. So
Awesome. And we will link to that resource list in our show notes. And would you guys share with us where our listeners can find you online?
Sure. You can find us on Instagram. We are at Able Appetite. So feel free to hop over and watch some really cute videos of babies eating.
Yes, we love babies eating.
Ways, in all different ways.
Yes, that's awesome. I'm so thankful to have you guys. It's such a journey. And I know, especially for those listeners out there in the early years, figuring out breastfeeding, bottle feeding, transitioning, all of those things, it's a lot. And I'm grateful you guys are out there giving us good information and walking us through it. So thanks for being here, Sarah and Sabrina.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you having us on today.
Thanks, y'all.
Okay, friends, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. What did you think? What did you learn?
Okay. So I loved the ladies addressing this, which is the posture and energy you bring to the table when it comes to feeding, because I feel like that was huge for me in even in parenting in general, right? Because you have to do like at-home therapies a lot when you have a child with Down syndrome. And that can be a lot of pressure because you're also supposed to be like really upbeat about it, be very like also calm. So upbeat, okay, but calm, inviting. And then your kiddo's not complying and it's a hard task, you know? And so then you're kind of like hot and sweating, but still kind of like grinning through your teeth. So I feel like that is probably amplified when it comes to eating and feeding. And Sunflower, I feel like in her early days when I could control the food a lot more and all that, feeding was actually easier. And I'm finding that we probably should look into feeding therapy now, because as she has more of her own ideas and likes and dislikes, I can see where she doesn't prefer greens. She likes fruits. She likes meat, but she doesn't prefer those nutrients. So I'm like, okay, what can we do? She doesn't prefer hot, extremely hot or extremely cold, but she'll do ice cream, but like, smoothies. She won't do smoothies.
Macy won't do smoothies either.
Yeah, I'm so bummed.
Same over here. Yes. It drives me crazy.
It drives me crazy. And that's bad energy. when I'm like, yeah, where I'm like, oh, but it's so good for you, Sunny. And look at mommy sitting with you. You know, I'll do the whole nine yards. I can be really Mary Poppins. And then when it's still not received, I'm like, oh man, I'm worn out. And I've only tried two times and I'm supposed to do it again later. So I feel like just that constant reminder of my posture that I'm bringing to the table and what I need to do that well, is, I'm glad they just talked about that, you know, 'cause that's hard. It's super hard. So I'm in it with any of you mamas who lose it sometimes or can't bring that good posture.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's hard because there, I mean, we all bring baggage to the table. We all have our pasts and the way we were taught to see food as children and the things that our culture has told us about food. And then we bring that to parenthood. And then you add in having a child who has extra needs around food, and it can feel really overwhelming.
Yeah. I really appreciated how they talked about, you know, like with our kids with Down syndrome, they're born and you have all these medical professionals who are saying like, they're not going to be able to latch. I mean, I remember that was one of the first things I heard, like babies with Down syndrome don't breastfeed, and that you enter into this space. They talk about this where like ableism is so rampant and we're supposed to combat that. But oftentimes you're a new parent. It's so overwhelming. Of course, you can't know what you don't know. And so listening to all this input and ideas around food, and then also probably your child had some kind of like a low birth weight, and or there's all this pressure to like make sure that they're getting enough, and then you take away any kind of control from your child that your child should, I like that they talk about your child should have some kind of control too over what they're eating. Whether they said something, oh gosh, I wish I would have written it down. It's like our job is to present the food, like we get to choose the food and maybe when they eat, and they get to choose how much and what they eat, or something like that.
Where you present it and they get to pick it up, feel it, play with it.
Yeah. But for us, I know for me, just as a parent in general, food has always been like what my kids eat is so important to me, because I want them to be eating good, nutritious foods. And I like feel this sense of success when they do and failure when they don't. Mm-hmm. And like, what is that connected to? And then you add in that idea that we're being told our kids with Down syndrome aren't able to do so much. And then we start to believe that, you know, that like, well, I'm not even going to try this because my kid has Down syndrome. So why would I try it? So just that we're like up against, I think it's so important to recognize, and I like that they bring it up, that we're up against this society where ableism is just exists so much so, and it exists in this feeding space. And so to be reminded of that, and to be the parent, right? And to see our kids as able, and then to present eating in a way that we are assuming competence and assuming they can, and not letting ableism be the deciding factor in how we do feeding for our kids.
It's so interesting, Heather, when you were talking, I'm going a different direction in this, but when we, it's crazy how, and Micah, you kind of mentioned it with baggage and everything, intimate, like sharing a meal as a family is, you know, and then like culturally, it's really intimate too. Like when I would bring sunflower to family gatherings with either my Peruvian side or my Black side, you know, these both sides are serving foods. Well, Sunny would do rice. She loves beans. She loves that. But both sides are serving foods that are a certain type of food, right? That's like for sunflower on my Black side, I'm not even being stereotypical. Like this is just what we would eat. Collard greens, like fried chicken, mac and cheese, sweet potato pie. And she is dairy free, gluten free. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like would sometimes offend the fam, like my family, you know, she needs to put more meat on her bones and blah, blah, blah. But then I'm like, this food is not good for her. So she can't eat that. Like, so it's kind of hard with that. And then on my other side, you know, she would just eat a little bit rice and beans, but not a lot. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, give her more, give her more. I'm like, oh, she doesn't want any more. You know, it's so interesting how even that kind of experience became stressful and kind of a little bit heart-wrenching, because then like food was another factor of maybe hard or different, you know, experience. It wasn't just easygoing, sit down, share a meal together.
Yeah. And I don't know about this, and maybe you have observed this or not, but how much of that is because Sunny has Down syndrome? Like, it doesn't matter if she with the other kids as much,
right?
And just how that ableism that our kids have to deal with in all areas. It's like, do people without Down syndrome are doing these same things that my kid with Down syndrome is doing,
right?
But no one says anything about it.
Yeah. She doesn't,
and I don't know if that,
picky, right? Like she doesn't just get to be a picky eater. This is now a product of her diagnosis
or something. Yeah. And I'm not trying to project that onto that experience, but I wonder if that's part of it too. Like if Rhodes is eating that way, it's not as much a thing because that Down syndrome piece isn't highlighted because he doesn't have Down syndrome.
Oh, I think it can be a thing. I unfortunately think anything Sunny could do that's quirky or different is not, it doesn't get to just be her. It first has to go through the filter of her having Down syndrome.
Yep. Yeah. I think we have a podcast episode coming up that we need to have this discussion. Because I can think of like so many conversations and scenarios. I feel like Mike and I talked about this a little bit when we were together, this idea, but that's not this episode.
That's not Able Appetite. But Able Appetite maybe spurred
it. Bringing it full circle, that they bring that up, even in the way that our kids eat. It's like they are up against ableism in the ideas of how they even approach mealtime and food time. And just, yeah, as parents, like I said already, being aware of that is so important. And I really love this conversation. I thought of so many parents who are going to listen, and I'm hoping are just feeling seen and heard and understood and have a place to go and feel hopeful, because mealtime in those beginning years, and maybe later for people, but man, those first years, when it comes to all things feeding your kid with Down syndrome, it's a lot. It's a lot to hold. So grateful for these women and their perspective and the work that they're doing, for sure.
Lastly, and it's brief, I like how they were advocates for parents, like even if they were specialists, right? And they're totally pro therapists, but they were advocates for parents to find therapists that work for you too. So like, even if you're with one feeding therapist, you know, if you need to seek a different one. And then always, like, I didn't even realize this until being a mom, like I would even ask, which is kind of silly, but like I would want to know, like, is this like a therapist in training or like a certain certified therapist, you know? And like I would always be like, so I don't mean to be a diva, but I'm only interested in such and such, because sometimes you just don't even have time to help train a new person, be a part of the training process, because I just didn't have time for that. So I don't know. I just loved their approach to like being very pro parent advocates for your child.
Yeah, they were amazing. They were awesome. Micah, thanks for that interview.
Mm-hmm. You are welcome. So glad we got to share it. So we are going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. And when we get back, it'll be time for our favorite part of the episode. Good news.
All right, friends, I'm here to talk to you about Sheltered Co. It's a wonderful quality company that makes weighted blankets. It's the only crocheted weighted blanket on the market. Its sturdy pattern will last over time and it gets better and better with time. It comes in 3 sizes to choose from and new colors come out every month. This quality blanket was created by a mother who has an autistic daughter, and she knows the importance of regulating your body and the need for better sleep. So if you are in the market for a quality weighted blanket, please check out Sheltered Co. It's crocheted by hand in Los Angeles with deadstock fabric that has no added filler. So you can head over there now, use the discount code LUCKYFEW15 for 15% off. And you guys, you won't regret it. This blanket, I have 2 of them myself. I love them for me personally and for all of my kiddos. It does get better with time, softer, and it's so gorgeous and will make any room in your home look so comfy and cozy and beautiful. Head over to shelteredco.com, use the LUCKYFEW15 for 15% off, and grab yourself a blanket. You won't regret it.
All right, we're back, and it is time for some good news. Truly, take it away.
Time for good news, time for good news. Everybody, welcome to the good news. Yeah, yeah.
All right, good news. What are we celebrating this week, friends?
I have a good news. And it is that August Riker Avis swam in the ocean. And I have another good news about the ocean. I'm going to save it for the next episode. And this is a huge deal, you guys. We are beach people. We love the beach. August has been going to the beach his whole life. And we've even, a couple summers ago, we Airbnb'd our house and then got a little condo in Hawaii. We did a 25 nights, so almost a full month. And August didn't go in the ocean one time in 25 days in Hawaii. Bless. And he's like terrified. It's almost like something comes over him.
Yes.
Where he's like panicked.
Yeah.
And we would try to like force him in, like, he'll get over it, you know, like just quickly dunk him under. But he's so panicked, even just stepping like 3 or 4 feet into the water holding him, he's panicked. So we didn't do that to him.
Yeah.
Anyway, when we were in South Carolina, and the ocean in South Carolina is not clear. It's like so very murky, but very warm. Basically like you're stepping into a bath and lots and lots and lots of waves. And he decided that was the time. And he swam in the ocean. Totally. And he would like started out kind of scared and just his normal like playing in the real shallow waves there. And then he put on his goggles and he was like jumping in the waves and rolling in them. It was awesome. So,
so
good job, August Riker, my little ocean swimmer.
Yes.
So awesome.
Do either of you have some good news?
I feel like I'll piggyback off of you, Heather. Sunflower has been depth diving the big waves. Do you know what I mean by that? Like going under them, where before I think she would just like try and jump them and then crash.
Yeah.
You know, I think yes. She was happily just suffering through getting pummeled. Now she is going under them. Poor sweet thing, though. I wish she would close her eyes because her eyes, like at the end of a beach day, are like so red and puffy. And we'll do goggles, but I also think she doesn't like the waves. I think she still needs to duck lower, even lower than she's ducking, but she's still like trying. You know, we've reached a new level of trying to go under a wave, which feels really good because it's kind of crazy being at the beach with 4 kiddos.
Oh yeah.
You know? And so I love, and they all love the ocean. So they're in the water. So just even that, like, sunflower, and now that Sonny's doing Rhodes, like, gets so much of his confidence through his big sister. Rhodes is doing it. And it's just been huge to see that, like, okay, possibly if a giant wave came, they will now choose to duck dive it.
Yes.
And try to run for their life.
And then get pummeled. Yes.
Yes. Sometimes they make it, sometimes they don't. And it's too scary. So I felt like that was like another step towards ocean safety.
Yes.
Which, bless, we need. And I will read it. One from one of our listeners. Okay. Al.mil22 says, after weeks and weeks of the bus showing up to our house and Hunter refusing to get on, Hunter, who's in kindergarten, is independently riding the bus to and from school.
Get it, Hunter. That's huge. I love it. Good work.
Sorry for all those weeks and weeks.
I know. Yes.
But we're so proud of you now.
I love that.
Yes. So yes, good. And such a good example of how we can't give up on our kiddos. So do it eventually. You just gotta give them enough time.
Present that food 20 times. Present the school bus 20 times. We got this.
Yes, on 21 we'll quit. I'm just kidding.
All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Able Appetites, and as always. Friends and listeners, we want to hear from you. So leave us a voicemail or DM on Instagram and share about your family and your good news about your loved one with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. And if you have a product or a business that wants to help us shout the worth of people with Down syndrome, we would love to partner with you. You can email hello@theluckyfewpodcast.com for sponsorship opportunities. And we want to give a huge thank you to our editor, Josh Avis, to our producer, Val Schleter, to our sponsor, and to all of you who have shared the Lucky Few podcast with friends, who have listened faithfully and cheered us on. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember that you, our dear listener out there supporting your loved one with Down syndrome, or you self-advocate out there with Down syndrome, you are a shouter of worth and a narrative shifter. So keep on keeping on. We are cheering for you. We will see you next week on the Lucky Few Podcast.
Bye, friends.
Bye.